Thanks for downloading this podcast. There are hundreds more just like it at abc.net.au/conversations, and we're on iTunes as well.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and podcast.
Naguib Qanawati is one of the world's most respected Egyptologists. He's the professor of Egyptology at Macquarie University in Sydney. His work means that he and his team labour in the sun and in the shadow of the Great Pyramids, unearthing with incredible, painstaking care the artefacts of life as it was lived before the birth of Christ, before even the Roman Empire. In 2003, he and his small team uncovered some of the best preserved Egyptian mummies that have ever been found in three coffins that were buried under 15 metres of sand and debris. Naguib Qanawati believes that the ancient Egyptians were probably the happiest culture on earth because they were sure that the next life was going to be even better than this one, and with all the earthly pleasures as well.
Just remind us of that amazing find. How long had you been working at that site before that extraordinary discovery?
Well, in Egypt, there's not one day that goes without finding something, so it's not really the find after so long. But I have been working on this site for about 11 years.
Is most of the stuff close to the surface, or do you really have to get down deep under the sands?
The site is approximately 12 meters deep, and once you get to the bedrock, you find buildings. So the site was originally a cemetery of a king called Teti, who reigned around 2300 BC, so it's 4,300 years from now. The cemetery was abandoned and was covered with sand, and every, say, 100 or 200 years, the cemetery is completely covered, and people just rebury, use it as intrusive burials. You find just coffins. So as you excavate from the top going downward in a stratigraphic order, you just keep finding mummies and burials from different periods. As you go down, you go earlier, of course.
Go earlier, and so you go back further and further in time.
Back in time, yeah.
Naguib, what is that like to just pull back the surface of the desert floor like that and find these remnants of an ancient civilization?
Well, it's just like practically reading a book of history. History is just like a jigsaw puzzle, and you try to really to put the pieces together. To me, history is just like a torn picture, torn to pieces, and I'm trying to put the pieces together, and the more pieces, the clearer the picture becomes.
Well, ancient Egyptian civilization was beautiful. Everything that they did on a large scale was brilliant. Everything they did on a small scale was beautiful and brilliant as well. This is the sort of thing that makes people very, very obsessive. Are you obsessive?
I am. The Egyptian wanted to live forever, believed in life, in perpetual life, and tried to really to perpetuate his life, to record everything, and recorded it in stone so it can last. He wanted to live forever, and indeed he did. So 4,500 or 300 years later, we are just studying him in Australia. So
do you think they built things and built these tombs to be remembered for thousands of years? Is this like a bit of a letter that's been sent to you thousands of years ago that you're picking up and reading?
In a way, yes, because for the Egyptian, going into oblivion is the worst thing that can happen to him. And many people ask me, do I feel any guilt feeling or guilt conscience about uncovering or opening tombs? And I don't think I do, because the Egyptian believe that the worst that can happen to him is to go into oblivion and nobody talks about him. And obviously, after 4,000 years, the cemetery is completely buried after, under 12 meters of sand. He went into oblivion, and I'm uncovering him and making people, look at us sitting here in the ABC talking about the ancient Egyptians. Obviously, that's exactly what he wanted.
Indeed it is. Tell me about the coffins you found there in this cemetery.
Every day we found coffins. It's not finding a coffin and mummy is not...
It's no big deal?
Not big deal. The big deal about these coffins, actually, is that these belong to 600 BC, so it's 2,600 years from now. At that time, they covered the mummy with a mosaic made of beads, small beads, but they work the face and the body details of the deceased in a mosaic made of very small, very colorful beads. The problem with beads is that the beads last forever because they are made of faience, like China thing, very colorful. But they are strung together with string. That decays. So invariably, when we find mummies of this particular period, the beads are collapsed, and we just end by having the mummy plus a basket full of beads. So beads are no big find. We find them on every mummy of this particular period. Usually, you carry the coffin and take it into the store and then open it. By the time you take it from the site to the store, all the beads are falling, you know, to the side of the mummy within the coffin itself. So I decided to open the coffin, which is totally against the rules. You don't open the coffin on site. So I said, I need security because of security. I called the security, and all the Department of Antiquities landed on me. How do you open the coffin on site? I said, well, I know that there is something here. The beads will collapse. Anyway, they gave me the permission. We opened the coffin, and the view of the mummy was just out of this world. It's beautiful mosaic made of beads we have never seen before. So I decided to work on the beads. I had to clean them because they are full of dust, of course. So we used puffers, the camera puffer. There's no textbook that tells you what to do, so you had to improvise. I sprayed it with soluble glue, water-soluble glue, and stuck the beads on the mummy cloth itself.
So that would remain in place then?
It would remain forever. And waited for half an hour, then moved it to the store. And by the time we finished, the mummies were absolutely unique. That's something that has never been seen before.
You are from Egypt itself.
I am. I lived in Alexandria for the earlier part of my life, yes. It was established by Alexander the Great, and therefore it's a Greek city practically, and it has lots of archaeological sites, but Greek and later Roman, of course.
Well, what was it about Egypt, ancient Egypt, that grabbed you then?
Maybe it's the belief in eternity, the hope. It's a very optimistic. People always think of Egypt as a very pessimistic culture, obsessed with death and the hereafter. And I didn't see it this way, and I still don't see it this way. I think it is the most optimistic culture ever existed. The Egyptian was not obsessed with death. He was obsessed with life. And because of his love of life, he wanted to perpetuate it. He couldn't believe that he would die. So he invented all these religious beliefs to convince himself that he will never die. He didn't want to die. People think that he's just waiting to die as fast as he can. But that's not true. You know, this optimism is grabbing, appealing.
So this is what got you inspired with Egyptology to begin with.
Mm.
But your dad didn't want you to become an Egyptologist.
No. No,
even though you're an Egyptian, you didn't want you to be an Egyptologist.
Egyptology is not really the most lucrative career. My father didn't want, obviously, like most fathers, think only of success. And if you want your son to succeed, you push him to finish the HSC, go into medicine or engineering or law or something like that. And he wanted me to do that, and I was planning to do it. I was studying to do one of these employable degrees. In Egypt at that time, we used to get a pass. Once you get your HSC, and before you join the university, once you are accepted at the university, you get a pass, and for 2 months, you travel on the trains free. Everything is free. Youth hostels, food, trains, everything is free. Access to the monuments, tickets, etc. Everything is free with this pass, which is a good idea. Only it changed my whole life because I went on this trip for 2 months, and then I came back That's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And my father nearly fainted, you know, when he heard that. He said, categorically not. Categorically not. I made a deal with him that I will study Egyptology at one university and business administration and commerce in another. I said, well, I'll do that for you and Egyptology for me. So I enrolled at two universities which could never communicate with each other and know that I am so. It was not legal, practically.
You weren't actually allowed to do 2 degrees. That was the law of the land at the time.
Yes.
How did you manage it?
I did one at Alexandria, one in Cairo, and there was no way that anyone would even have suspected that I'm doing it. It's Cairo and Alexandria, they are 203 kilometers apart.
So how could you do that?
I traveled between Cairo and Alexandria daily on train, and that was where I studied.
Every day you went?
Every day.
200 kilometers?
Going to Cairo, I studied business administration. It took 3 hours. It's a very comfortable train, 3 hours. I studied 3 hours business administration going to Cairo and 3 hours Egyptology going to Alexandria.
And you study on the train, which you just
on the
sat
train.
There.
I did my two degrees on the train, practically.
And no one was aware? No one was aware of this at all?
No one was aware. So I graduated masters in Egyptology and business administration in the same year.
How did you actually then come to Australia?
When I applied to come to Australia, they accepted me as a master's in business administration, not Egyptology. Egyptology was not mentioned at all, in fact, in the interview or the application at all. There was no Egyptology in Australia, so there was no point in applying as an Egyptologist. I would have been rejected offhand. So I applied as business administration, which, of course, I was, and I was employed as such. And that's how I came to Australia. And the day I arrived, I started looking at universities to continue my studies. Again, not to as a job, as something I love. I couldn't just abandon because I immigrated. And there was no Egyptology at all in any of the universities in Australia, altogether.
Why did you feel you need to leave Egypt behind?
That was the bad time of Egypt. I came here in 68, and as you know, in 67 there was the Six-Day War, and Egypt fell into a very depressed situation. I was in a very good job, but the whole country became, the mood of the country was very bad. Also, Egypt was going into a direction which did not agree with my nature. They were going into the Russian sphere. Lack of freedom of expression was suffocating practically. And we as young graduates, we were young and we liked to really to think that we are the intellectuals of the country and we can talk, but we couldn't. So many of my friends were imprisoned and for just saying something against the government or something like that. And I decided that it's time to leave because I don't like to be deprived of saying my opinion or something. So I decided to leave.
Still, it must have been a very hard decision for you. Not only, of course, you know, you have your family and friends, but you're also an Egyptologist leaving Egypt.
Yes, but the lack of freedom is something that we here in Australia don't understand. We never experienced.
So you came to Australia, and then you said about badgering universities to let you study?
I travelled from, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide, Brisbane, every university, every large university, trying to find a university that accepts me as a PhD student. And I had my master's at that time, so I didn't really need to do any courses in Egypt. I mean, I have done already a thesis for my master's, so I need to do another thesis. But they don't have a supervisor. They don't have the subject. It's not taught. Ultimately, and after 2 years of persistence, there was a professor at Macquarie University called Professor Judge, to whom I owe a great deal. He said, well, you seem to be very persistent. I'll organize a supervisor from a local supervisor to be administrative supervisor only. But your real supervisor would be from overseas because they know the subject. He appointed two people, one from Chicago and one from Liverpool in England. These two supervisors have been marvelous to me, and they were always responding to questions. It took time, but that's how it is. And I finished my PhD here. And Professor Judge said, well, tell me something about your background. So I told him what I have done. And he said, well, I'll give you a scholarship to be a full-time student if you do something to combine the 2 degrees that you have. Because that seems to me original enough. And I did my PhD on the administration in ancient Egypt.
That's how you got round it. So tell me then how you got your first teaching job was actually in New Zealand, not Australia. Tell me how that came about.
I was just flipping the papers, looking for a job in the administrative sphere. I mean, and just my eyes just caught this position, lectureship in Egyptology, University of Auckland. And I said, wow, at least there is some hope. And I discussed it with Professor Judge, who is a New Zealander himself. And he said, well, apply. I said, well, I'm still a student here. He said, apply. At least they get to know you. If there is another position, they will think of you. So I sent an application, and I was on a short list of four, the last on the short list.
So you were fourth preference.
Yes. And I think they put me on the list, not because of my qualifications. I was still a PhD student. So I don't think that they put me. They put me because probably out of good New Zealand-Australia relationship. So they put an Australian, putting me as number four. There was no hope at all. I mean, you have three ahead of you. If the first declines it,
the second will get it.
So putting me at number four is as if it's a more gentle way of saying no. So I was number four, and that was in 73. And the war started in Egypt again.
Oh, the Yom Kippur War.
Yes. The
1973, yes.
Absolutely. And all Egyptologists were trapped in Egypt. It was the very end of that time, you know, of 73. So all the Egyptologists, the three ahead of me, were trapped in Egypt. So they sent, at that time they used to send telegrams. The first, no response. The second, no response. He did not decline the position. Ultimately, they wanted to start in January, and they took me. So they offered me the position. I couldn't believe my eyes.
I'm in conversation with Egyptologist Professor Naguib Kanawati, who by a combination of huge talent, luck and unbelievable determination is now a world-renowned Egyptologist. And he's based here in Australia at Macquarie University. So tell me how your business training actually helped your studies in Egyptology, Naguib. How did that work?
My thesis was in the administrative system of ancient Egypt. I'm not interested in the kings. I'm interested in the people. So I am really still working in the administrative, you know, area, but in ancient Egypt.
And that gives you an insight into day-to-day life of ordinary people in Egypt.
Yes.
I mean, the common image we have of ancient Egypt, and I suppose we get this from the Old Testament, is of a vast slave state that was able to create these incredible monuments on the back of this incredible army of slave labor. Is that true?
No.
No?
No. That's not true. It might be true from the point of view of someone who doesn't understand Egyptian culture. But the Egyptians built all these monuments not because they were slaves, but because they practically worshipped the king. He is the only intermediary between all the other gods and themselves. And you need really to preserve him and to give him perpetual life for your own sake. And they believed in it so much. If we really accuse the ancient Egyptians of slavery, then I would say that the people who built the churches in the medieval period or early modern history, for example, even those who built St. Mary's, for example, were slaves. Do you accept that?
Sure, they worked hard.
They worked hard, but it's belief can produce miracles, can produce fantastic buildings for the glory of what you believe in. So the Christians who built the churches at that, you know, these magnificent churches, without having even the machinery that we have today, they produced things that we cannot do today.
The ancient Egyptians, they seem to have an incredible amount of knowledge.
Absolutely. They were very advanced in mathematics, in astronomy, in medicine. They were a very advanced civilization. And regarding the ancient Egyptians as a primitive culture is absolutely wrong. I look at their buildings and just examine even the way they handled the stone. I assume without the machinery that we have, it's mind-boggling. How they cut these pieces and laid it on top of each other, you can't even without any mortar or anything, you can't introduce a razor blade between two huge blocks of stone at anywhere.
So we still don't know how they did it.
We know, but it doesn't explain it. We know how they did it because we have actually unfinished stones as they cut it. Sometimes it's split and cut wrongly, and so they abandoned it. And because of these unfinished things, we can study how they did it.
We hear lots about the curse of the pharaoh's tombs. Is that a myth? All the people that have died in strange circumstances and of diseases?
The effect is a myth, but there is a curse. I mean, the Egyptian wrote a curse on his tomb. So there is a curse written on many tombs, practically every tomb, because the Egyptian doesn't want you to desecrate his tomb. And therefore, they write on the tomb, if you desecrate this tomb, if you violate the tomb, I will follow you in the hereafter. I am a powerful person, not because he's dead. I mean, the dead is considered as very powerful. It's unlike our belief. They believe that once you die, you become a very powerful spirit, and you become actually, you have a new entity in addition to yourself, which is a glorified spirit, which is almost divinized.
Therefore, almost like a god.
Almost like a god. You mix with the gods, so you become almost one of them. And therefore, you are more powerful than the living. We were excavating and found a dish placed in front of the door of the tomb where the deceased spirit will come to receive offerings. They need to eat. And there was written on the dish a letter to the dead by his wife. So she prepared him a meal, put it in the dish, and wrote the letter. The dish is made of pottery, and she wrote him a letter. And she tells him, my servant is really misbehaving herself. Since you died, she became very naughty. And why, when you were alive, she was behaving herself. Why don't you do something about it? So she was still nagging him.
I think that's hilarious. So you open these tombs that are thousands of years old, and you see the domestic politics there, right there in the tomb in front of you.
And she tells him, and by the way, if you cannot do anything about it, wake up your father or your cousin. They were very powerful men. So do something about it. You know, I am suffering from her.
So she's saying that, well, if you're too weak to do something about
exactly.
it. Exactly. Yeah, get your father. He was a strong guy, not like you.
Exactly. But that tells you also how they believed in the power of the dead. I mean, the man is dead, but she realizes that he can do something. Otherwise, there is no point, really, in her asking him to intervene.
Let's talk about your own domestic household situation, Kanawati. Because your wife is only interested in living beings, isn't she, rather than dead ones like you? Is she?
Yes.
As a senior lecturer in French literature?
Yes. My wife studies French literature, and it is contemporary French literature. So she likes to interview her subject. So she studies the novels of someone and then interviews him and sees why he wrote so and so on. Once he dies, she loses interest in him, and she moves to another writer who is still alive. And she always tells me, I don't know what you are living in 5,000 years ago, and how can you really communicate with these people? But I feel as if I know them, because the ancient Egyptian did not leave just a building. The tomb in ancient Egypt is not just a grave. It's almost an illustrated biography. So, for example, I'm working on a tomb at the moment, which is belonging to a prime minister called Mereruka. And the tomb is 32 rooms decorated. The tomb is like a palace. And you'd be astonished that there is not a word in such a culture that is based on death.
There's not a word
for tomb.
The Egyptians had no word for tomb.
No, it's house of eternity, you see. You build your house with mud brick and your tomb with stone because you live there forever. And this tomb, 32 rooms decorated. Can you imagine the amount of information that you can put on the walls of 32 rooms? And the rooms are bigger than this room. One room, for example, has six pillars. supporting the roof because it's huge. And this one out of 32 rooms. And the amount of scenes and inscriptions, I mean, you can spend practically as a visitor, you can spend 3-4 days looking at this tomb. I work on this tomb for maybe 2 or 3 years. And after that, I really feel I know the man. I know his moods, I know his likings and dislikings, I know his family in detail, all of them. There are pictures of scenes of him with his family, what he's doing, what he likes, and so on. So it is not true that I live with the dead. I don't consider them as dead people. I know everything about him. So the Egyptian left us so much information, unlike any other culture. It's an open book. You just go in a tomb and you have the life of a person, not the death of a person, the life of a person.
Finding these tombs and these incredible artifacts must be one thing for you, Nagib, as an Egyptologist. But would the secret dream of an Egyptologist be to have the proverbial time machine to step inside and to actually spend a day walking among the streets of ancient Egypt?
I wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't?
No, I wouldn't. It would kill the fun of Egyptology, the fun of a historian trying to put the pieces together and recreate something as you think it is. Maybe if I go back in time, maybe I'll be shocked. Maybe I'll be disappointed.
It would be like not doing a crossword, but going straight to the answer.
As I said, for example, if you have a picture torn and you are putting the pieces together, that's the fun of finding another piece in the jigsaw. But you give it to me all like that, all right, I'll have a look and walk away.
Well, thank you so much for putting the pieces together for us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.